Good morning, and welcome once again to the UBS Virtual Financials Conference. For our next session with StepStone Group, we're very pleased to have Scott Hart, Co-CEO, and Mike McCabe, Head of Strategy. Before we get started, just a quick administrative note. UBS Research is required to make certain important disclosures about our business. You can find those at www.ubs.com/disclosures. And with that, thank you again, Scott and Mike, for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. Look forward to getting in depth with StepStone Group.
No, thank you, Adam. We appreciate you having us, and it's great to be here with you today.
So just to start off, for those who may still be a little bit less familiar with, number one, the StepStone story, but also where StepStone and other solutions providers sit in the private assets ecosystem, could you maybe talk a little bit about that, how the firm came to be, and the customer need that this segment of firms is really addressing?
Sure. No, look, I think that's probably a great place to start. And I think the way that we like to think about it, Adam, is that we sit in between our clients, the limited partners, which are typically institutional and increasingly individual investors who are looking to gain access to the private markets, and in between them and the fund managers or GPs who are looking to raise capital to allow them to invest directly into companies, properties, or other private markets assets. We're not trying to intermediate that relationship, but we are trying to facilitate, in our case, the commitment of over $50 billion into the private markets on an annual basis. And the way we do that is by reviewing, sourcing, analyzing, et cetera, over 3,200 investment opportunities that come to us in the form of primary fund investments, secondaries, and co-investments from those fund managers or GPs. I mean, I think to your question, a little bit of how we got there, I think one of the things that we recognized when we were founded back in 2007 was that the private markets were evolving. They were growing in size. The LP community was growing more and more sophisticated. And as a result, some of the existing solutions in the market were no longer meeting the needs of those clients. And so we really came to the table looking to build portfolios specifically designed to meet the needs of our clients. We look to do that again through a combination of primary funds, secondaries, and co-investments. We did that in a sort of hybrid, way between advisory relationships and asset management relationships, which I'm sure we'll get into. But that was really what drove both the founding of the firm has really been a founding principle since that time. I think the other important question to ask is, why does that position in the ecosystem matter? Why is that important place to sit? And I think clearly, it's well known private markets are in high demand today, but there are a number of barriers that exist for investors, whether big or small, that are trying to access the private markets. One is, many of those LPs are resource constrained. And they may have a small team that sits in a single office, may have limited ability to travel. This is not true of all LPs, but certainly many. Yet they are being asked to cover an increasingly complex private markets landscape. It's become more global over time. We've seen a proliferation of managers, both in terms of the number of different funds, the number of strategies, the number of sub-strategies. And so again, trying to cover an increasingly complex market with a relatively small team. Access is important, and whether we're talking about trying to gain access or gain allocation to a highly oversubscribed, in-demand fund, or whether it's frankly just trying to identify which managers what one should consider. And for many, the approach is not simply to invest with a small number of the largest funds out there. To give you a sense for our business, we are consistently approving over 200 new fund investments on an annual basis. And so it is a significant community of GPs and funds that we're evaluating and covering on behalf of our clients. Those clients, they're looking for something that is customized, that's specifically designed to meet their needs. Their needs may be very different if they are a new investor to the asset class that's just getting started relative to one that's been actively investing in the private markets for the last 20 or 30 years. And so they're not necessarily looking for a one-size-fits-all approach, but an approach that's designed specifically to meet their needs. And then lastly, I'd say they're trying to do it in a relatively cost-effective, fee-efficient way. And I think we offer certain strategies, and certainly being able to leverage our platform allows them to do just that, again, in a more cost-effective way than perhaps trying to build those same capabilities, those same resources themselves. And so when you think about those challenges, you know, I think clearly the specialized expertise, the scale, the breadth of coverage that StepStone brings to the table pretty uniquely positions us to serve our clients, to get them access to the full array of private markets investment opportunities, to customize a solution to specifically meet their needs, and really, again, do that in a cost-effective way.
Excellent. No, that's perfect, Scott. Thank you. And you've hit on a couple points that I think would be good to follow up on. One is you alluded to, you know, the complexity. It's not nearly as simple for an LP, particularly a smaller-sized LP or institution, to just allocate, right, to private assets or even a certain asset class. There's, you know, the complexity, the huge number of funds and GPs out there, as well as, you know, the specific client needs around, you know, liquidity, the J curve, managing the cash flow. One of the things I think that sets StepStone apart is your data capabilities and the systems that you've built out around that. Could you talk a little bit about how that helps you design customized solutions for your LPs?
Sure. Well, look, again, I think it goes back to some of the observations that we made at the time that we were founded. I think even back 14 years ago, we were talking about the importance of data, the fact that in the private markets, unlike the public markets, data is not available to everyone. It's available to those that are participating in these investments. And as one of the most active private market participants today, we clearly have access to a tremendous amount of data. It's high quality data in that it comes directly from the GPs. It's very detailed in that it goes down to the underlying asset level. And so we decided early on to make a heavy investment in the technology that would allow us to capture and then analyze that data. And I think it's proven to be an incredibly useful tool for us at StepStone. As you can imagine, we are the most active users of that technology and of that data. But I think we've also found over time that giving our clients the same access to the same tools that we are using is very much appreciated, helps them do their job more effectively and more efficiently, and ultimately creates a stickier and stronger relationship with our clients. So I think in a lot of ways, you know, utilizing that data to make better investment decisions, utilizing the technology to improve the efficiency of our process, but also I think we're finding ways that data can help power new investment solutions, whether it's thinking about some of the multi-asset class portfolios that we are building, whether it's thinking about, you know, for example, the C-Prime product that we offer to high net worth investors, where, you know, we're very focused on making sure we don't have a significant cash drag, but to be able to model from a strategic asset allocation standpoint, it's important to have that data. Not only in private equity, but really across asset classes to help with that exercise.
Excellent. No, that's perfect. And it's interesting that, you know, and LPs may or may not realize on the inbound, you know, as they get into the private asset space, how important the data is. Is there a typical migration in terms of LPs either, you know, what's their first touch point with StepStone? Is it to invest in a commingled fund? You know, do they start by accessing some of the database and admin services? How does that usually work?
Yeah, I think one of the things we struggle with a question like that is it's hard to generalize, because I think we've seen it happen in many different ways. I think we certainly have a number of examples where we start to work with a client on an advisory basis. Over time, you know, you develop a tremendous amount of trust and a very good relationship with that client. And as new challenges pop up, you know, they look to the StepStone partnership to try to help address that issue. And I think it goes to being a solutions provider. And so over time, perhaps they then expand the relationship into areas like co-investments, because they're trying to bring down the overall fee burden across their portfolio. If perhaps they're trying to replicate the success we've had working with them on the private equity side across other asset classes, and the relationship may expand. It's certainly not a requirement. I think we have many clients where we work with them in a single way, but, you know, we talk about the fact that of about 35% of our clients today work with us across multiple asset classes. Close to 40% of them, of our advisory clients work with us on both an advisory and an asset management basis. And so I think that gives you a sense for how the relationship develops over time. But again, I think it does come back to this question of what does it mean to be a solutions provider? And I think for us, look, again, that really starts with looking to build portfolios specifically designed to meet the needs of our clients. I think to be a successful solutions provider, you need to have a number of different tools in your toolbox to be able to address a wide variety of challenges that may crop up. Again, in our case, that toolbox consists of four asset classes: private equity, infrastructure, real estate, and private debt. You know, across those four asset classes, we really pursue three different key strategies: investing in funds, secondaries, and co-investments, which we think just have a tremendous amount of synergy between them. When you think about the due diligence benefits, you know, what you learn when you're in the trenches working on a direct opportunity alongside a GP, which then can be applied to the fund investment due diligence, or determining whether you're investing alongside of a GP in their sweet spot based on all the analysis that you've done of their track record and their team, we think has tremendous benefits from a diligence standpoint. Also has tremendous benefits from a portfolio construction standpoint. When we're thinking about helping clients to mitigate the J curve, thinking about how we can help them bring down the overall fee burden across their portfolio. And then finally, I think the last, you know, part of the toolbox that I would talk about is, you know, we're willing to work with clients in whatever way works best for them. And that kind of goes back to your question about where does the relationship start. You know, for us, we're just as happy working on an advisory, separate account, or increasingly a commingled fund, you know, basis for our clients. And I think that's something that's worked incredibly well for us over time, being able to engage with them in the way that works best for them, as opposed to, you know, enforcing or insisting on a specific structure based on our needs.
Thanks. Perfect. You alluded in your remarks a couple of times, actually, to the co-invest idea, which is becoming more of a theme. Could you talk a little bit about how that helps maybe mitigate the J curve, maybe mitigate the fee structure, you know, the level of demand you're seeing there, and how you're able to go about sourcing those, especially from the GP sweet spots that you mentioned? I found that intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah, like, it's interesting. I think as clients' portfolios grow in size, I think over time, you know, one of the things they become quite focused on is how do I continue to access the private markets, but in a relatively cost effective way? And what you see, and I'll use private equity as an example. I mean, private equity has been a 2-in-20 model for the most part for a long period of time. And a part of that is because the returns that have justified that fee structure. But what's really emerged are only a couple of ways that LPs can typically bring down the fee burden on their portfolio. One of them is through scale. I think certainly if you're able to make a very large scale commitment, that may warrant a reduced, you know, a reduced management fee or even a reduced carry. And two is through co-investments, which oftentimes, you know, we're able to pursue on a either no fee, no carry, or at least a reduced fee and reduced carry basis, on behalf of those clients. Now, when you think about those being two of the key ways that one can manage their fee burden, you know, many clients on an individual basis either aren't large enough to execute on that scale benefit or don't have the team or the resources to pursue a direct co-investment strategy. And so we'll look to a group like StepStone to help execute on those opportunities and really achieve that fee advantage in that way. On the second part of your question around sourcing those opportunities, look, clearly when GPs think about who they want to partner with, they want to partner with some of their largest and most important limited partners. They want to partner with groups that have the capability to execute on co-investments. And we continue to hear that, you know, co-investments are the kind of thing that everyone talks about, but a smaller group can actually execute upon. Increasingly, as we've seen the co-invest market move from a post-signing syndicated market to a pre-signing co-underwriting market, even more important to have the capabilities and the team to move quickly there. And so those are really some of the keys when it comes to sourcing opportunities, combined with having a large universe of GPs to source those opportunities from. And I think clearly given the level of activity across the StepStone platform, the $50 billion per year that we and our clients are allocating to the private markets, we're pretty well positioned there to tap into that deal flow.
Excellent. Yeah, you allude to the benefits of scale, which I think is especially, you know, for some who may be new to this subsector of the industry, you know, the idea in a traditional asset manager, scale weighs against returns, right? You, as you get scaled up in a fund or what have you, it's more and more resembles the index. Whereas I think one of the important features of alternative asset investing, and in particular, the solutions provider business that StepStone runs, is the benefits of scale. You want to talk a little bit more about that, and we'll talk about one area in particular where you've scaled up recently.
Yeah, I actually might ask Mike to jump in on that one, if you don't mind, Mike.
Great. No, thanks, Scott. Yeah, I mean, we say scale matters in this industry for a very clear reason. You know, if you just think about two LPs, you know, one who has, say, $50 million to allocate and another who has $5 billion to allocate to the asset class, you know, the investment opportunities available to each investor is going to be remarkably different. And, you know, the larger scale investor is going to have the comparative advantage and can develop a different kind of relationship with GPs simply through purchasing power. And so the benefits of scale, you know, come in the form of allocation, preferential fees, you know, first call for co-investments, secondary investments, and, you know, even softer benefits like access to market intelligence, industry trends, and just a daily dialogue with a manager. So, you know, this is why we at StepStone have identified scale as a strategic priority for the firm. And so as our asset footprint is now nearly almost $500 billion and we allocate, as Scott mentioned, you know, more than $50 billion a year, you know, the benefits from StepStone scale accrue to all of our clients. And so both large and small, and that feeds this flywheel effect that Scott often discusses. So scale has been and will continue to be a really important strategic advantage for StepStone as those benefits accrue to everyone that we work with.
One of the ways that you've scaled up recently was through an inorganic opportunity, that with recently announced Greenspring acquisition. Tell us a little bit about that, in particular, given your focus on providing customized services and solutions. How does Greenspring fill out the StepStone offering in that way?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I mean, I think, look, the first thing I would say is that, you know, we've got a history and a track record of pursuing similar types of inorganic opportunities. And I think the Greenspring acquisition, you know, fits into that mold in the sense that we have, in a number of cases throughout our history, brought on large, experienced, senior teams to help to either build out or accelerate the build out of certain capabilities within StepStone. And that's clearly the case here with Greenspring in the venture and growth equity space. We have been operating in venture and growth really since the inception at StepStone. But I think one of the things that we have found over time is that the conversation has really changed. So I think in the early days at StepStone, you know, the question was really probably purely around access. You know, do I have access to the top tier venture managers? You know, for some of our larger clients who may be committing a significant amount of capital to each fund, the question was, can I really even invest in the venture space in an effective way? And I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen over time is that as companies have been staying private for longer, as we've seen technology touching more and more parts of the private markets or just the broader economy, I think that conversation with clients has really shifted in a way. And in fact, you know, one of the most common conversations we seem to be having today, including with our large scale clients, is how do I build a venture and growth equity portfolio at scale? And so I think clearly what the Greenspring acquisition does for us, you know, creates what we think is a, you know, pretty clear market leader in the venture and growth solution space. We will have one of the largest and most experienced team in that area, or allow our clients to pursue that conversation that I just mentioned in a much more effective way. And I think the announcement has been received in that way. I think the strategic rationale is well understood, and clearly, you know, clients on our part, you know, recognize that this will significantly enhance our capabilities in the venture and growth space.
How is venture and growth, particularly venture, different from other types of private assets, you know, categories that you might be involved with? People think in terms a lot of, you know, I think buyouts and sort of established, portfolio companies that are already at scale, whereas in VC, it tends to be small but very fast-growing companies. How does that affect the way you invest?
Yeah, look, I think it affects the way that we invest in a few different ways. And I think, again, it's an area that we have been active for a number of years. There are certain challenges that exist. But I think with the platform that we built, there are ways to address those challenges. I'll maybe give an example from the pre-Green Spring days. But one of the commingled fund offerings that we have that focuses really on the venture and growth space, I think this ties into how we think of ourselves as a solutions provider and how that can be true even in the case of a commingled fund, which in a way is not customized to for each individual investor, but I think can be viewed as a solution nevertheless. And I think one of the things our team did a number of years ago was look at what are some of the challenges associated with investing in the venture space. Whether those may be the loss ratios, whether it may be the time to from investment until liquidity. Again, this point I made around companies staying private for longer, the access component that I mentioned. And what we really did was design a strategy that we thought helped to alleviate some of those challenges and really to capture some of the upside associated with investing in venture and growth, but to do it in a risk mitigated way. And I think that what we've seen, in our discussions with Green Spring, and we found this early on, is that we speak the same language. We've taken a very similar approach to investing in the asset class, again, through a combination of funds, secondaries, and co-investments, or in their case, a bit more of a direct strategy. And I think this is also in recognition of the fact that while there are a number of similarities, and this is true when we look at our different asset class businesses as well, there are a lot of similarities, but there are some key differences as well. And I think one of the things that we see in the venture space is that given the nature of some of the financing rounds being done in multiple series, is that there oftentimes may be an opportunity to step up and lead around as a direct investor, still very much doing it in partnership with our GP relationships, leveraging that relationship, leveraging the data and information that we have at our fingertips, but doing that in more of a lead way, which is a bit unlike what we've done on the buyout space. And so I think that's another key difference, and frankly, one that the Green Spring team has done a particularly good job of.
Excellent. There's two questions that that I get from investors that maybe you'd want to address, and about the Green Spring acquisition, and which, as you say, has generally been very well received. Number one is the question, and it's not very pointed, but there's a sense that in the VC space, the big important funds are closed. And that would affect the investment landscape, possibly in a limiting way. And then the other question, maybe go ahead and ask that one first, and then I'll burden you with the second one. Thanks.
Mike, do you want to jump in at all, or I can keep going?
Why don't you continue on? I'll grab the next question, Scott.
Yeah. So look, Adam, I think what I'd say there is, one, in the case of Green Spring, we have the benefit of this is a group that's been around and doing this for 20 years. And so they've got a lot of, fantastic, relationships with GPs, very long-standing relationships. And frankly, what the combination will do will result in a multiple of the number of relationships that we both oversee. And part of that is because of the nature of our business where we work with individual clients on a customized, in a customized way. And that has resulted in a large breadth of relationship across both the venture and the growth space. And I think the other thing I would say is, interestingly, as we kind of look at the overlap and what we were doing, there maybe was less overlap than you would have expected in the sense that Green Spring has been more venture focused. We've probably been a bit more growth focused. We were probably both heading in the other's direction. So very, very excited about the opportunities in both venture and growth. But I think that's certainly, a part of it. The other part is what I mentioned earlier, which is I think over time, it's become less of a pure access game. I think that's certainly still the perception, but I think over time, as we've seen the asset class scale, as we've seen the asset class become more global, as we've seen the emergence of a number of leading venture and growth platforms where there may be multiple strategies, maybe multiple stages ranging from early to late to stage to growth equity, I think it has, the game has started to change a bit. And I think in our view, having not only the capabilities that our team has, but also having the scale to bring to the table and maybe create solutions, you know, for the GP side as well. And when you think about, you know, the StepStone, you know, mission is really to be the trusted partner of choice in private markets globally. And that's a partner of choice for both LPs and GPs. And I think this really helps facilitate that in a lot of ways.
No, that's well said. That's good. The idea of partnering with GPs as well is something that, you know I forget about sometimes. So that's good. And VC being less of a pure access game, I think, is an important insight because it brings in all the other capabilities that StepStone provides. Mike has courageously chosen door number two. So hopefully we'll live up to expectations. One of Greenspring's business is indirect, and one of the questions that investors had was, does this represent a shift in StepStone's overall business model? So could you talk about that and maybe the similarities and differences between Greenspring's direct business and the co-invest that we already talked about at StepStone? Thanks, Mike.
Sure. No, thanks. Fortunately, Scott has already partially answered this question, so I'll just tag along what he had said earlier. But it's an important nuance, and it's really Greenspring's secret sauce to how they've been able to successfully scale in venture capital like other groups have not. And, you know, I think before I even go further, you know, I do want to recognize that, you know, Ashton Neuhall and Jim Lim, you know, started the company 20 years ago. And so, you know, they've spent two decades trying to figure this out. And direct investing has been, you know, one of their key strategic advantages. Why? Because what they've done is they have recognized what Scott identified is being a preferential partner to general partners as a scale limited partner can lead to other things. Co-investing in the buyout world is clearly one of those. In the VC world, there's certainly a robust co-investment activity. But as Scott mentioned, it's a little bit different because a portfolio company in a VC fund could go through a number of series and a number of different rounds. And that GP may be at the end of a fund life or transitioning between funds or might be at some sort of concentration limit, but they don't want to give up governance and they don't want to give up other areas of influence. And so they would like to bring in a friendly partner to perhaps lead a round. And that is what Greenspring has been doing. Is they have been leading series and rounds with GPs with whom they've invested. So it's a derivative of co-investing. But in the buyout world, co-investing is more of a pure pari passu, same security, same terms, same deal kind of relationship. In venture capital, it may not always be pari passu. It may be leading around with, you know, that friendly capital to augment that Series E, Series F, or whatever it might be, that allows a GP to extend its relationship into a portfolio company through a capital partner like a Greenspring now StepStone.
Yeah, right. A little bit of a two-step there. That's good. And finally, on Greenspring, I just wanted to ask, I mean, we've talked about the strengths of their firm and a lot of the advantages, which are compelling. Give you the opportunity to speak for them, but how did they choose StepStone as, you know, as more than a partner, but as someone to really combine with? And what were the attractions on their end?
I mean, Ashton and Jim and their team built a fantastic organization. I think they could have probably picked any partner they wanted to, frankly, given that they are the clear leader in the industry and their brand is strong. But I think what they saw, as Scott mentioned, was that we speak a very similar language. Culturally, the fit made a lot of industrial logic, and they saw how scale is such an important strategic part of their business, and they recognized how StepStone sees scale as a, you know, a strategy for us. Scale matters. They said, hey, well, StepStone's already built out this massive global footprint. Data and technology is core to what they do. They have a lot of influence in the market. And so what they recognized was the combination of our world-class teams and platforms and then leveraging all the infrastructure that we've created allows their team to spend more time with general partners, more time deal sourcing, more time adding value to limited partners and clients. And so they get to simply leverage what we've built as a public company in terms of infrastructure to just further enhance their process and capabilities. And we at StepStone already have a fantastic venture capital and growth equity team, But when we did the deep dive analysis, we realized how broad this universe of VC really is, because the overlap of manager relationships we had with the manager relationships they had, certainly there's a Venn diagram and there was some overlap, but not as much as we thought there would be. And so there was also an augmentation of relationships in the GP community as well in both directions. So, you know, we just felt that the industrial logic was there, the cultural fit was there, speak a similar language. It was a good point in time for them, 20 years into their business at scale, to make this kind of transition. And we're just frankly delighted to have them as our partners and members of our team.
Excellent. I'll move on a little bit from Greenspring and I'll broaden it out, because you mentioned, you know, global distribution, global partnerships. And I think that's something where, you know, and if you want to, you can talk about maybe the synergies of putting Greenspring into that kind of global network that StepStone has, but maybe talk a little bit more broadly also about StepStone's approach and philosophy to being global but multi-local, and then where you're seeing opportunities in terms of maybe expansion on that front.
Yeah, no, look, I think it once again goes back to some of the founding principles or some of the observations that we made very early on in our life at StepStone, which was that we saw that the private markets were becoming increasingly global, and that was both as it relates to, you know, where capital was coming from, but also where investments were being made. And I think we recognized pretty early on that in order to appropriately service our client base and in order to you know, have the right due diligence insight from an investment standpoint, you needed to be global. You needed to have your feet on the street, your people on the ground in these markets, the ability to speak the language, to have the local relationships, understand how business gets done in these local markets. And I think part of what was important and led us to kind of continue this strategy over time is that we had a number of, you know, examples where we saw the importance of this at play. I'll maybe just, you know, share a couple of those examples. You know, one of which was, you know, certain of the large, you know, maybe Asia pension funds that we started to work with, you know, now 10 or so years ago, we started to work with before we had a presence in those markets. And we certainly, you know, thought that we were making, you know, progress, that we were providing a good service, that the relationship was building. But as we added a local team in certain of those countries and markets, the difference we saw, you know, overnight was tremendous in terms of how much more open the dialogue became when you could converse in the local language, when you could be much more responsive because you had people on the ground in the same time zone and could very quickly go and meet in person. I think it's one of the things that we're seeing during COVID. You know, we're starting to see travel come back slowly. That travel is mostly domestic as opposed to international. But for us, having 19 offices around the world means that even if you're just traveling domestically, you can touch, you know, a lot of those clients, and where it's, you know, safe and appropriate to do so, can start to spend some time in person. And so again, we saw the change overnight as we added those local resources, and that, you know, that relationship has now blossomed and it spans multiple asset classes, it spans, you know, advisory and asset management. So I think that it's just a sort of proof point that gave us the conviction to continue with this global and local approach. The other example I might share is more on the investment side, where, you know, I can think back to one of the early co-investments we did in China that was one that had a bit of noise around it. There was a lot of diligence that needed to be done. I think if we were sitting, you know, purely in the U.S. and trying to get our arms around this opportunity, would have been tough to do. But with a local team on the ground, in this case in Beijing, that happened to have, you know, specific expertise and experience in that sector, was able to speak with a number of GPs, was able to speak with a number of the service providers that were performing diligence, and hopefully get us comfortable in moving ahead with that opportunity, which went on to be a fantastic deal. That again was one that we probably couldn't have sourced, and we certainly could not have diligenced appropriately without that on the ground presence. So I think that those are examples that, again, you know, helped us understand, you know, early on that, you know, this is, again, 10 years ago, the importance of being global and local. I think clearly the approach has paid off. And I think if you look today, you know, plus or minus 70% of our management advisory fees come from clients based outside of the U.S., particularly in some of the fast growing fast-growing markets from a private market standpoint. So it's an approach that I think has served us well.
Where's opportunity right now internationally? What markets either that you're already in that you expect really fast growth, or that you're not quite in yet, or maybe, you know, looking around the edges and would like to get into?
Yeah, so look, I mean, I think if you look at some of the growth forecasts for the private markets and then start to break that down either by asset class or by geography, you know, what you see is that some of the faster growing asset classes may be areas like private debt and infrastructure, and clearly we've been well positioned there with the multi-asset class, you know, business that we built out. From a geographic standpoint, when you look, you know, clearly Asia, markets like Asia, Middle East, Latin America tend to be some of the markets that are growing faster than the overall business. And so I think it consists of both markets where we are on the ground today, but there's more to do, and maybe some other markets where we are expanding into or have expanded into over the last several years here. So really a mix of those markets.
Excellent. I want to shift gears a little bit, and it's maybe for folks who aren't as familiar with the story, but if you could, talk a little bit about the evolution of StepStone, how the firm from the inception, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, through some of the recent, you know, pre-Greenspring, some of the combinations, acquisitions, and how that works with the different teams for different asset classes, and maybe touch on the non-controlling interest aspect as well.
Sure. I can start, and Mike, you might want to jump in as well. But, you know, Adam, you've heard me now refer back to some of the founding principles a few different times, right? The focus on customized solutions, the focus on data and technology, you know, really the global and local approach. The one thing I haven't, you know, touched on as extensively is the multi-asset class, you know, build out. And, you know, that was something that was not evident to us at the time of founding. It was really something that started to emerge, you know, 7 or 8 years ago when we started to have conversations with clients where they say, look, we love StepStone, what you've built for us or what you've done, you know, done in partnership with us in private equity. We are trying to find similar solutions in real estate, infrastructure, private debt. Or you'd have conversations with a different subset of clients that said, we don't want to have a separate partner across each of these asset classes. We want one group that we can have a strategic partnership with across the entire private markets, because it's important to understand what we're doing in each of these asset classes. And I think as we heard that more and more, it became pretty clear to us that the approach we had taken in private equity that we've described, again, investing in funds, secondaries, and co-investments, partnering with clients on an advisory separate account or commingled fund basis, would work really well in those other asset classes, but that because the opportunity, at least initially, would lie with expanding some of our existing client relationships, we needed to make sure that we were bringing the same high level of quality, high level of client service to the table that we had brought on the private equity side. And so what we set out to do, you know, rather than repurposing a member of the private equity team who had, you know, worked in the distress space and calling that private debt, or somebody who happened to work on an energy deal and calling that infrastructure, we said, let's go out and identify these large, experienced senior teams that I referenced earlier, and bring them in-house. And I think the good news there was we were able to identify teams that did exactly that. It took time, but I think as we look back now, you know, really feel good about where we've gotten to with each of the asset class teams. You know, we often make the comment that, look, each of those individual teams or individuals that are leading those teams could frankly be running their own business. I mean, we say that because they were running their own business in many cases, either independently or as part of a larger organization. But I think they ultimately came to realize something very similar to what Ashton and Jim and team at Greenspring recognized, which is that what we could build together at StepStone was more exciting than what either of us could build independently on our own. And I think that's played out over time and has really driven some of the growth, not only in those asset class businesses, but across the board for StepStone.
And then in terms of how we've organized these structures, Adam, it's been a purpose-built design. And the reason that we built it this way is because, as Scott mentioned, we brought on very large senior industry veterans. And each of them have run their own businesses throughout their careers. And for us as an organization, our culture really stems from a very entrepreneurial, equity-like, ownership-like concept. And so when we brought on the real estate team, the infrastructure team, the private credit team, we created these equity arrangements so that they would think like an owner and act like an owner and see the upside to their success available and accruing to them. And so what we've created were these sort of team of teams with equity partnerships that allow these teams to grow and reinvest in their teams and also think about compensation as more of an upside rather than a W-2 kind of arrangement. And that has bode well for us, and it bears out in our numbers and our performance and the way we've grown. So the way to think about NCI at the moment is really just a source of compensation for our teams to continue to invest, you know, in their platforms and their technologies, their data and everything else that we're doing. So it really is a team of team approach with an equity-like culture, think like an owner, behave like an owner, and grow the business like an owner. And that's really the intent and the design there. And it's worked incredibly well.
And then maybe touch a little bit on the end game down the road for some of those situations.
Sure. You know, in the case of Greenspring, you know, they were two decades in the making, 20 years. It made perfect sense to buy complete ownership. 100% of their FRE is going to drop to our ANI. That made perfect sense. With these other asset classes and teams, you know, they're in various stages of growth. Call it 3, 4, 5 years since merging with StepStone. So what we're thinking is it could take some time, but medium to long term, you know, we would expect to, you know, buy the NCI into StepStone Holdings and have a one equity kind of culture. But again, that will be, you know, as they reach a certain maturity, once they've reached a certain ramping up phase, you know, you can expect those conversations to ramp up. But in the meantime, short term, the arrangement we have in place is working incredibly well. But long term, we do see sort of a one equity firm.
Yep. No, makes sense. Yeah. And right. In the meantime, you've got that strong alignment. And as you say, the entrepreneurial upside oriented opportunity, I think, is important.
That's right.
We've got a couple of minutes left. I did want to touch on what yesterday in the earnings call, you talked a little bit about C Prime and the success that you've had there. The return performance has been excellent. Some of the AUM growth. Just want to ask as a follow up to that, two parts. One is, you know, is there, and maybe you've already reached it, but is there an AUM level or a level of scale where you're looking for maybe a tipping point in growth and the platforms that can sign on? And then, you know, what the short term outlook is in terms of, you know, marketing and actively distributing the product.
Yeah. So look, I mean, I think it again, you know, we've talked a lot about certain trends that have helped to drive the business over the last, you know, 14 years. I think as we then look out into the future, I think there's clearly more room to run, you know, whether it's across different asset classes, a global approach, customized solutions. But clearly one of the opportunities on a go-forward basis is the individual investor. And it's an area that we've been active already. I think if you look at the individual investors who are broadly defined to include not only sort of high net worth and mass affluent, but also family offices, defined contribution plans, you know, not so much in the U.S. today, but in other geographies, it represents something like 20% of our business today. So this is an area that we have been heavily focused. You're right. You know, C-Prime is a product that we are currently in market with today. Again, I think goes back to my comments around being a solutions provider as we think about the challenges for the high net worth individual investing in the private markets, you know, not wanting to have to deal with K-1s, not wanting to have to deal with capital calls, trying to achieve diversification when you may only have a single ticket to invest. You know, providing really a solution down to the accredited investor level, really designed a product that was meant to address all of those needs. And I think for that reason has been, reasonably well received. We talked about the progress that we've made to date actually through the beginning of August. You know, the net asset value on that fund has now reached $170 million. So continue to make progress month after month here. You know, currently actively, working with over 50 different, organizations that are now sort of investment committee approved, and focused on the C-Prime product. And I think the next question is the one you asked around, you know, achieving scale. I think we're getting, you know, closer. I think as we surpass the 100 million mark, the 150 million mark, and now approach, you know, hopefully the $200 million mark in the coming months here, you know, I think that opens up, you know, further doors. Because I think certainly either from a concentration standpoint, or just the overall scale of the fund, you know, certain institutions or certain channels, will become more focused on it as we achieve certain of these milestones. And I think we're getting closer there and excited about, the reception we've had for the product, on a go forward basis here.
Excellent. Thank you, Scott. We are up against time. So on behalf of our audience and on behalf of UBS, I'd like to thank Scott Hart and Mike McKay from StepStone. Great discussion, gentlemen. Very much appreciated.
Thanks, Adam. Appreciate having us.
Thanks, Adam.